Hi, welcome to this week's program. Most people, either through necessity or a spend now, worry about it later attitude, never save and reap the benefits of growing world economies. I call these the have-nots. Living from paycheck to paycheck, they fail to seize the chance for their money to build upon itself and to create some wealth and security. This lack of savings never gives them the freedom to be unshackled from money concerns and to have enough money to benefit from the better life that money can bring. The pursuit of money in itself is not enough. Its real purpose is to help you feel secure, to help you take care of loved ones, and to achieve financial independence. Those who can save are able, through their 401ks, their IRAs, and other investments, to accumulate money to protect themselves from unforeseen life events, such as a bad marriage or health issues or a child's wedding, for example. These are the haves. These are the people who have been and may continue to be the beneficiaries of rising economies and the rising stock values that come with that. Now, while I grant you that ideas of happiness, success, and wealth vary widely from person to person and communities to communities, it seems safe to say that most of us want to be in the have category. Few of us want to struggle through life and retirement without any savings or assets to fall back on. Unfortunately, though, the stark reality, even in a wealthy country like ours, is that only a minority of people accumulate enough savings needed to maintain a comfortable lifestyle into their old age. The good news is that it doesn't have to be that way, and a few simple changes and rethinking can help you climb your way into the haves class. To start, consider putting aside a piece of your working income and investing it. This is the main way to help build wealth because you gotta have money to make money. Next is to understand something very basic. There are only two types of investments: owning something, like a home, a business, or shares in a stock or a mutual fund, and lending money, like investing in a CD, a money market, or a bond. Of the two, owning something offers potential for more wealth and financial independence. Another word for owning something is equity. The equity in your home is a good example. Your home equity is the difference between the worth of your house and the amount remaining on your mortgage. If the house rises in value and your mortgage stays the same or goes down, you gain wealth. Earning wealth this way does not require you to sit at a desk all day working. Your equity becomes more valuable over time, even while you sleep. What's better than that? That is why for most people, owning a home will be their greatest wealth creator. Owning stocks is the same. If the company or group of companies you own, such as index funds or mutual funds, become more valuable, your shared ownership becomes more valuable too. This process takes many years to potentially work. Stock markets have outpaced inflation in the long term throughout history, and long-term stock ownership has created wealth opportunities for millions of investors. Another main difference between the haves and have-nots is that most haves first developed a habit of saving and investing during their working years. The earlier you start saving, the better the probability to develop wealth down the road. And there are two main reasons for this wealth effect. Since 1928, the compound rate of return on the S&P 500 has averaged about 8 to 12% annually. Yeah, this is an average rate of return, so it happened in a very up and down way. Some years the rate was higher, some years it was wrenchingly lower, but over time, the approximate 8 to 12% has been the average. So the miracle of compound interest and compounding dividends and the compounding earnings from these companies allows the money you've invested to build on itself. As an example of compounding, consider a retirement account where you've chosen to purchase an index fund. When that fund pays dividends, the dividends are reinvested back into the same fund, so you buy more shares, and the next dividend is a little greater because you now have more shares, and that builds and builds. Future earnings then are based on the sum of the principal, you know, the money you've paid in, plus all the money earned and reinvested, and this results in a gradually steeper and sweeter rate of appreciation in your account. Note that while you also receive the benefits of compound interest from other investments, the low returns you'll get these days from money market funds and bonds and CDs means you won't get very far with compounding. On the other hand, after several decades of regular deposits made into your savings, the average returns from your stock investments, and the math of compounded dividends, the results can be truly phenomenal. It's worth touching on a few details about retirement accounts, since they, along with your home, are the common ways to create and grow equity. 401ks and the various IRA plans should be designed to grow your money. Here's something to consider. Make your investments boring. Nothing sexy, no hot stocks, just plain vanilla index funds that are invested in a boring and diversified way. Why boring? Because fortune may favor the patient investor. So embrace the boredom. Also, if your 401k plan includes matching funds from your employer, this is one of the best deals you're going to find anywhere, so it would be truly foolish not to take advantage of it. Who in their right mind would give up free money? Here's a few more tips for your investments. First, keep it simple. Minimize fees and taxes with index funds. Consider investing in a small number of low-cost index funds or ETFs. These can be more tax-efficient, allowing you to keep more of what you earn, and generally, they have lower fees compared to actively managed mutual funds. Another one, forget about beating the market. Putting all your money into a mutual fund because it had a great run and beat the market returns over the past 2 or 3 years is not a good strategy. Most of the times, these funds end up being below average anyway, so you might as well stick with boring, low-cost index funds. And don't chase market trends. Timing the market is a job for wishful thinkers, chart technicians, and many charlatans. It's not for the value-minded, serious, long-term investor. Unfortunately, the desire to beat the market or avoid the pain of a downturn leads otherwise intelligent investors to buy high, sell low, and repeat until broke. Also, make your retirement savings automatic. Automate transfers from your paycheck into your retirement or savings accounts. If you don't see the money first, you'll grow accustomed to managing your life on a lower monthly budget. The bottom line is to position yourself to become a have, and the only way to get there is to start building equity. If it makes sense for you, consider buying a home, consider starting a business and succeeding at it, or funding an IRA or 401k, or just putting money into a low-cost index fund month after month for years and years. A systematic strategy can separate you from the woes and constant worries of living from month to month in a cycle of struggle. And finally, to all of you listening to me today, you are the only one that can summon the courage and discipline to break out of your old habits. Read some books, find someone you can trust to guide you, but fundamentally, the change will always have to come from you. This is something you have to do for yourself. You have to make it a priority, and you have to do it now. Time marches on, and the wealth accumulation is reduced for every year that you wait. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Paige DeFiore is the formal editorial assistant at Credit.com. She's a blogger and generally really just a smart cookie. The proof of this is a recent piece she penned drawing on the actions of the nefarious, troubled, and downright dangerous Harry Potter villain Lord Voldemort. It's his diabolical actions that, when used for good, can serve as an example of how to get what you really want out of your money. Welcome to the show, Paige.
Hi, nice to be here.
So let's get this out of the way. You know, Lord Voldemort is a very, very nasty character, and you're not suggesting anybody murder anyone or become a villainous snake wizard, right?
Definitely not.
Okay, that's good to hear. By the way, for those of you who don't know, Voldemort's main goal was to kill Harry Potter, but how does this make him a good example for someone who's good at managing money? Let's find out. So tell us what transpired to make you think about Lord Voldemort and being a good steward of your own money.
Well, when it comes to finance, I know that when it's tied to something that I have an interest in, it's so much easier for me to understand and want to read about it. So when I was trying to come up with ideas, I was trying to think of what's something that's really strange and crazy to kind of pair with money. And I thought, how about one of the worst villains of all time?
What about his actions and the way he feels about things that would make him a successful money manager?
I mean, he is dedicated. There are so many movies, and every movie has the same goal. So when you're saving money, if you're dedicated, that's the first step. Mm-hmm. And he's also very widely broadcasting his mission. Everyone knows that he wants to kill Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to saving money, if everyone knows that you're saving money, it makes it so much easier.
Well, he lives, actually, he's dead now, I guess. You know, talking about a fictional character being dead. But he was driven by so much hate for Harry Potter and what he represented that every single day he plotted to destroy him. So are you suggesting that a person get to a certain point, maybe not through hate, but through some other feeling to get their act together?
I mean, I think it's a great motivator. If you're really motivated, if you kind of paint like debt as a villain, it can be really helpful in kind of making you want to like just take control and conquer it.
Well, you know, also in the case of Voldemort, it led to a lot of career longevity because he was in 8 movies and 7 books. So maybe there's a lesson there as well. What are some of the other characteristics? You write, be ruthless with yourself. What's that mean?
When it comes to money, it can be hard because you don't want to feel like you're depriving yourself by saving, but you really need to be a bit ruthless. You really need to look at where you're spending your money and think, do I really need this? Is this something that is making my life so much better that I can't afford to be without it? He's just very ruthless. He just didn't care and kind of stuck to his main goal. And when you stick to your main goal, you have to be a little ruthless with yourself and be a little hard on yourself, at least I think.
In your article, you had a link to how to save without feeling deprived. And I copied and pasted that. So let's talk a little bit about that. To prime your frugality pump, as it's written here, some painless ways to pinch pennies without depriving yourself of the things that you enjoy. Number one, I guess, brew your own coffee instead of going out and spending. You're not depriving yourself of coffee. And maybe the coffee's actually a little bit better. Any other ideas of ways to save without feeling deprived?
I think when you're looking to buy things for yourself, if you really kind of go through what you have and see how many things that you already own, and to just focus on being grateful rather than saying, I need the next thing, I need this thing. Because in reality, you're probably not as deprived as you think. If you kind of take a moment to kind of have gratitude for what you have, you might not feel as inclined to spend.
Yeah, you know, and maybe quit eating out as often as you do. Shop smart. Don't fall for stores' tricks. You know, they are masters at marketing and they know how to target your emotions. And make sure that you understand your emotions and you can walk away. Because, you know, really the facts are that if you don't act and you do walk away, there's actually, I believe, just a 90% chance that you won't end up buying that item on the spur of the moment. Here's another one that interests me about your article about Lord Voldemort is wear a uniform. Why would that help me?
One of the biggest ways a lot of people spend money, I know a lot of my money is spent on clothes, is when you feel like you need to keep following trends and buying new outfits. But a really big thing, and it's really famous with a lot of CEOs, is kind of wearing a uniform, wearing the same outfit almost every day or every day. You just have a go-to outfit formula, and it kind of downsizes your wardrobe, and you could sell other clothes, and you won't feel as inclined to spend money on clothes, and it will also save you a lot of stress when you're worrying about what to wear.
Mm. Especially, I think, for women. I think men tend to kind of wear the same thing pretty much every day. I know I keep a blazer in my office, and I kind of come to work with, you know, basically a shirt, no tie here in South Florida. And then when it comes time to see clients, I put the blazer on, and it's really quite simple and really, I guess, don't spend. But I'll tell you one thing I do is when I do buy clothes, I buy good quality clothes. And while you may pay up for that initially, in the long run, it's best because the clothes last longer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Here's another one. And you mentioned this before, share your mission. I mean, everybody knew that Lord Voldemort wanted to find and kill Harry Potter. Why is sharing your mission so important?
I think when people around you know your goals and know that you're really trying to stick to them, you have people that will hold you accountable. And when it comes like time for the holidays or when your friends constantly want to go out to eat and they know you're on a budget, they might better accommodate you. You might say, hey, like this year, the gifts aren't going to be as expensive and it's not going to be like really difficult because they know your mission and they really want to help you. once they know what you're trying to do.
I think there's also a psychological aspect of talking about it, of getting it out there and getting other people involved, as opposed to kind of just, you know, internalizing it and kind of suffering yourself. There's some kind of catharsis that they may help you succeed at this well. Here's another fact. A focus on actually understanding. I guess Voldemort's ultimate demise resulted from his lack of understanding about a certain curse. Tell me about that.
So had he known that a certain curse would backfire when he used it at the time that he used it, he probably could have avoided getting killed, at least for a bit longer. So when it comes to money, if you actually understand your finances and know your credit score and know what all of it means, you're setting yourself up for success. Because if you go into something not actually knowing what's going on, just kind of like, oh, I'm going to save money, but you don't actually know the intricacies of it, it can backfire.
Yeah, so don't be caught up in denial. And remember the old idea that if you're sitting at a poker table and you're wondering who the patsy is, that means you're the patsy. So you got to be the smartest person in the room. And one way to do that is to know your stuff, know your credit score, know what's in your bank account, know what your student loans are, know what the rate on the student loans are. Just know your stuff so you don't make a big mistake. Here's one. Keep a diary. Why is that important?
I think that when you can see where you're spending your money, where you're getting your money from, if it's all laid out in front of you, whether it's on physical paper or even on an app, there are so many apps out there, it can really help you like look at everything and cut your spending because you can see where everything's going. It's not just like a vague idea. And it's also a lot easier to keep track of your savings when you have it all written down.
Know your history is another one. Voldemort had a slight obsession with his heritage. Why is that important?
When you know the mistakes that you've made in the past and you know how long you've had your accounts open and what's really been eating your budget, it can better prepare you for the future. Like they always said in history class, when you learn history, you're less likely to repeat it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think that's a good lesson for our politicians as well these days.
Yeah.
And finally, a couple of last ideas here. Start young. You know, I'm always talking about that on the show. The magic of compounding really takes place or really reveals itself when you start young. And as the years tick by, it's pretty amazing. Voldemort created his first, I don't know how to say this, Horcruxes?
Did I
said that right? Okay, at the age of 17. So, you know, I don't know what a Horcrux is, but he started early and that seemed to help him. And finally, find the motivation that works for you. His actions were motivated by true hatred and hunger to rid the world of muggles. I guess you better find a different kind of motivation.
Yeah, I think a good motivation, I mean, you could take a page from his book and really be motivated by an anger and a hunger to just be free of debt. Or to rid yourself of debt.
Right. Okay, my guest, Paige DeFiore, former editorial assistant at credit.com, blogger. What is the name of your blog, Paige?
It's called Eyeliner Wings and Pretty Things.
Eyelinerwingsandprettythings.com. Pretty cool. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
To hear this segment again and to find out all the links that we mentioned here with Paige, don't forget to come to our website and follow our show at stevepomerantz.com. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. You know, your odds of becoming a millionaire aren't what they used to be. They're better. A record number of U.S. households have reached that enviable goal. I've asked Sandra Block to join me to outline the five routes to success. Sandra is Senior Associate Editor for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Five routes to success. Sounds simple. Is this one of those things that's simple but not easy?
Yeah, it's not rocket science, but it does require a certain amount of discipline that many people find hard. And in fairness, too, oftentimes people do have setbacks that they, you know, aren't responsible for that right. can get in the way of getting there. But the steps aren't, you know, genius. They're just requires that you school yourself.
Mm-hmm. And exhibit some discipline to try to, you know, get to your goal.
That's right.
You know, a lot of the ways that people think that high net worth households have accumulated their wealth is mostly with stocks, but that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, it's across the board. I mean, I think in terms of your long-term investing, stocks do have the greatest potential for growth, and people who invest regularly and early in the stock market have the greatest chance of getting to $1 million nest egg by the time they retire. Mm-hmm. But that's just one piece of the puzzle. Obviously, your income, your earnings are a big part of that. And one of the things we point out is that people who start their own businesses, even though it's risky and a lot of businesses fail, you control your destiny that way. And those folks have a really good chance of reaching $1 million if they have a successful business and find a niche that grows. I think that was one of the points made in the classic Millionaire Next Door. The survey found that mm-hmm. most of the millionaires he talked to did own their own businesses, because then you're not relying on a boss to give you a raise.
And we're not talking about having to be the next Google or the next Uber. We're talking about just good, small to maybe even slightly medium-sized businesses where, you know, you can build in a good profit margin and, you know, hire just enough people and keep the rest for yourself.
That's right. And you find a niche that there's room for. And in stories I've written before about people who start their own businesses, one of the things that experts say is you should start a business with the idea that someday you will sell it to someone bigger. And that's how people really get rich.
Yeah.
If you start a business with somebody, you know, some huge entity, and we see this practically every day, you know, when Facebook buys some app or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, the ability to scale up is key to really making a lot of money as a business owner. But, you know, to start out, it's just a matter of finding a market where there's a need.
Well, you know, if you think about it, and we're going off topic here just a little bit, but I enjoy talking about this stuff. So, you know, what creates wealth in the case of a business? Well, you know what it is? It's net cash flow. It's the amount that you're getting out of the business. That cash flow has a value to someone, and someone's willing to pay a multiple on that value. So if you've got, you know, cash flow of $1,000, someone may be willing to pay $10,000 for that. And that means that they're earning a 10% return. They're spending 10 and they're getting 1,000. That's 10%. So it's that multiple factor that creates this wealth. If the company will pay you 20 times earnings or even 5 times earnings, that can do a lot for you. So without beating that up too much, I think we've covered that. So investments, having your own business. What about inheritance? You know, there's this sense in America that, you know, people with inheritances are a large part of becoming a millionaire. Is that true?
Well, I think people need to be realistic about the likelihood that they will inherit money, because as people live longer and healthcare costs go up, I think it's a bad planning error to assume that your parents are going to leave you a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that baby boomers are sitting on a lot of assets, and some of those assets will pass to their children. And the windfall can be, you know, modest or large, but it offers so many opportunities for more growth, whether you inherit $50,000 or $250,000 or more. If nothing else, you can use that to, you know, get out of debt.
Yeah.
You can invest it. The key is whatever the windfall is, to look for a way to use it that it will get larger. That's how a windfall helps you become a millionaire.
It's saving a dollar today with the idea that you're going to get something far greater than a dollar in the future, and that's what you're going to count on.
That's right.
Yeah. So what are some of the obstacles here, you know, to becoming a millionaire? I know one that comes to my mind is that as soon as a person gets a raise, they start to spend more. Is living large one of the obstacles?
It's a really big, experts call that lifestyle creep. You know, you get more money, so you decide to buy a bigger house mm-hmm. or a sports car or something like that. And the problem is that these types of expenditures don't increase your overall wealth. In fact, they can decrease it because the cars depreciate, houses actually might be a good investment, but they, you know, cost a lot of money to maintain them. And the bigger the house, the more you're going to spend on maintenance.
Yeah.
So the idea that, it, you know, that you have to increase your living standards as your income increases is going to prevent you from reaching this goal. And again, you know, in The Millionaire Next Door, what they found was that the millionaires next door didn't live like millionaires. They drove old cars. They lived in the smallest house in a nice neighborhood. And that's really the key, because it's just so easy to let your lifestyle get away from you.
You mentioned The Millionaire Next Door. That's a book that was written many, many years ago. It's still in print, I'm sure. So anybody listening here, just go ahead and get that book. It's a fascinating book. And it's the guy next door that's driving the old Ford pickup truck who you don't really know what's worth. He's not living as if he's worth. You know, the extreme example of that is Warren Buffett.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and obviously he can have any house or car that he wants, but he has, you know, lived modestly and basically from the beginning lived modestly and just reinvested everything that he got. And, you know, all of his earnings he put back into his portfolio. And that's sort of, again, how you keep your money working for you instead of putting it something static where it just buys something that costs money to keep.
Yeah. And don't forget, if you buy a car, you buy an expensive car, it's a beautiful thing. It's a joy to own, but that car depreciates over time. It does not necessarily become more valuable later. And everything you want to think about with your money beyond, you know, your basic consumables is, you know, is this thing going to be worth more later? All right. So let's talk about ways to get to that millionaire level here. Number one, automate your savings. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's basically the idea. I mean, it's a typical 401k plan. The money goes into your account before you see it. And that's how I think the most effective way for people, particularly when they're young, to get started. You can't spend what you don't have. There's tons of studies that show now that if people are automatically signed up for a 401k plan, they won't opt out. But if you ask them to opt in, they won't get around to it. So, you know, just put it on autopilot so you live with, again, that's a good way to prevent lifestyle creep. And then make sure that as your income increases, the amount that you automatically have taken from your accounts increases too.
Also, if you don't have access to a 401k, you can always do an IRA. And one idea is to pay yourself first.
That's right.
Be the first monthly bill that you pay, because that's going to pay off in spades later on. The next one here is invest in yourself. You have a good story here about a person who was the hearing child of deaf parents. Take us through that.
That's right. And she... basically, her parents owned a computer store back in the 80s when they had big computers. And a small part of their business provided assistive devices for the deaf and hard of hearing. And she saw a need there. And she basically bought out the company. Her mother was a co-owner and started a company providing, you know, very high quality interpretive services to Social Security, to local governments, domestic violence centers, courtrooms. And at the time that she started the business, there were only a handful of companies doing this. So she grew very fast. She's very dedicated to the deaf community and, you know, had a very healthy profit margin. It shrunk a little because more companies have gotten into it, but it's a growing business. And basically she saw a need and she filled it and grew the company very fast.
Yeah, she started off, the company had annual revenues of about $800,000 in 2015 and 3 employees, but it grew to 62 employees and more than $6 million in annual revenues. And I can tell you that creates a lot of wealth, that kind of money, that's for sure.
Yes, it does. And, yeah. And especially with the kind of profit margins that she was getting. So that's wealth. And you know, and in her case too, I think there's a great amount of satisfaction in what she does as well, because a lot of the services they provide are to underserved hard of hearing people who, you know, often are in a situation where they're traumatized or, you know, are having difficulties, and they can help these people.
Another idea here is to channel Warren Buffett. We mentioned him a little bit earlier as a way to not experience lifestyle creep. But what other ways can we channel Warren Buffett for success?
Well, basically, you know, Warren Buffett says that, you know, that as long as there's capitalism in this country, you can make money buying shares of good companies and buying them and holding them, you know, forever. And basically, you know, it's a little hard for some people to think about doing that now because the stock market has done so well and they're worried about, you know, how long is this bull market? And there's a lot of things going on in the world that make people nervous. But, you know, the tried and true strategy is just to, you know, buy good companies and hold on to them and don't try and time the market. And I think the other thing that is useful now is there's so many ways you can invest in the market, invest in a diversified portfolio for very, very low cost. You know, you can buy index funds, you can buy ETFs.
Right.
So you're not giving a lot of money away.
Right. I agree.
To manage it, but you can get a really broad diversification of stocks and other investments.
You know, I want to talk about timing a little bit, because when I started in the business a long time ago, the Dow was at 1,000, the Dow Jones Industrial was 1,000. You know, everybody was worried, hey, this Dow's going to go to 800. I mean, how ridiculous does that sound right now with it around 22,000? So yes, the Dow is high, but these companies are growing. And if you have enough time, the Dow is going to be 40,000. It's going to be 60,000. So, you know, try not to worry too much about how current events is going to affect us. Unfortunately, Sandra, we are out of time. Boy, that went really fast. Sandra Block joins me. She's a senior associate editor for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. And where can she find you, Sandra? Where can people find you?
This story is on Kiplinger.com.
Very good. Sandra Block would be the person with the byline. Thank you so much for joining us. And to hear this conversation again, don't forget to join us and to join this conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Thank you, Sandra. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Hey, this is new. People with student debt now may be able to roll that student debt into a mortgage when they buy a house. Wow. Tell us about that.
I know. It's exciting. Beginning immediately, Fannie Mae is expanding their cash out refinances. That's going to allow borrowers to use lower interest rates equity in their homes to pay off your higher interest rate student loan debts. So you're basically rolling it in.
Yeah. So if you're paying 4% on your mortgage and your student loan debt is 6%, they're going to allow you to cash out and pay off your student mortgage. And in effect, you're switching your student mortgage into your student loan into your home mortgage, which is pretty cool, but it's got some downsides, and I want to talk about that in a second.
That's right.
Don't forget that student loans are unsecured loans, whereas your mortgage is secured. So if you don't pay the loan, you could lose your house. That's dangerous.
Right, exactly. And that's the risk.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is that student loans are somewhat flexible. The repayment schedule is somewhat flexible. So if you run into some financial trouble, you can kind of extend the payment, pay less. But on a mortgage, you better pay your mortgage. That's it. You got to pay a mortgage. So that lack of flexibility with a mortgage may hurt you if times get a little rough.
Exactly. So it's an individual, you know, case by case situation if this is something that would work better for you. But certainly paying a lower interest rate, I would find very attractive.
It's also tax deductible.
That's true.
For most people.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So also you gave me some information about the best cities in Florida to flip a home. What are they?
Yeah. Very interesting. Of course, we're recording from Florida, and in Florida, what we're looking at, Steve, is Tampa as being number 6 on the list, mm-hmm. followed by Orlando as number 16. In more of our local market, we've got Pembroke Pines, which is kind of a suburb of the West Fort Lauderdale area. St. Petersburg, that's ranked number 36, and then it goes all the way to 51 at Cape Coral.
Mm-hmm.
55, Jacksonville.
Where's Miami on this list here?
Miami is number 110, mm-hmm. so that's not really a real hot spot.
Mm-hmm.
Really, Tampa and Orlando were the two best in Florida, and only Seattle and Atlanta have more places better than what we have here in Florida.
I had an associate who was buying houses in Tampa and remodeling them, and a lot of them really needed a lot of work. And, you know, he was very successful at that. He did a very good job, and then he held them for a couple of years, and then he's been selling them. So I know that a few years ago, that was a really good market, and it's interesting to see it on this list once again. All right, let's talk about first-time homebuyers. You know, a lot of our discussion over the years, Terry, has been about this fact that appraisals for a home never really match up with what the market is actually stating a home is worth. Tell us about that problem and how it's affecting first-time homebuyers now.
Sure. Well, we're seeing it again now. As the market increases, the homes, when you buy a home and there's a mortgage involved, the bank goes in and appraises it. And the home has to appraise in order for the lender to lend you the money. Now, if there is a shortfall, let's say, for example, you sell the house for $300,000 and it appraises for $280,000, the buyer always has the option to put down an additional $20,000 to make up that shortfall. Mm-hmm. But what we're saying here, the reason why it's hurting first-time home buyers is they don't have usually the cash to make up that shortfall. So, for example, here's a story where there's 22 offers. Well, you may have been somebody who really wanted the house and you were willing to pay $325,000 for it. Mm-hmm. But if it doesn't appraise and you can't come up with that shortfall, the seller's not interested in even accepting your offer. So a seller in many cases will take a cash offer that was, you know, for less money because they know that they're not going to have to deal with this appraisal issue.
Yeah, yeah.
I just had this happen the other day. I sold a house for $670,000. I had another offer on it for $675,000. The first deal fell apart. It had nothing to do with the appraisal. The buyer just walked away. But when I went to appraise a home, it came in a lot less. It came in around $650,000. And because the seller wasn't in a position to try to fight it and argue it, because you have to pretty much get a new lender, get a new appraiser, the buyer went ahead, the seller went ahead and accepted, you know, this offer for $25,000 less. When I know for sure I could have sold it again if we went to a different appraiser or a different buyer for more money.
Yeah.
So this is what we're seeing. This is reality in a market where the prices are rising.
Well, we were talking about that, and that is the phenomenon here, is that when prices are rising, there's always a lag because they're looking at comparables for houses, sold in the last 6 months?
They look back about 6 months,
right.
And there is a lag.
There's a lag. So your prices are rising now, but it's not showing up in the comps because it includes homes that were sold 6 months ago, four months ago. So there's a lag when prices are rising, and it's the reverse when prices are falling as well.
That's right.
So it's really an issue. Now, can you go and get another appraiser?
Well, you can, but you have to start with a new lender in many cases, and not 100%, but for the most part, you have to start with a new lender.
Okay.
They won't let you just change an appraisal when you're already working with a specific lender.
Okay.
You know, again, that's not 100%, but in most cases.
So, Terry, here is something that's extremely interesting that I saw. Real estate investors should look for homes close to Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or the German grocery store Aldi for better prices or future appreciation. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy study, but homes near Whole Foods have seen stronger home price appreciations recently, an increase closer to those seen, you know, a higher increase than Trader Joe's or Aldi. Real estate investors who want to try to maximize a return via flipping or renters should check out these neighborhoods, which I think is kind of crazy. I'm not sure what the correlation is. What came first, the houses in the neighborhood or the stores?
Well, that's true. I mean, I guess if you have a Whole Foods in your neighborhood, that may signify that it's a bit of a more upscale neighborhood and prices may be rising.
Right.
So it's not necessarily correlation, but it is interesting that also maybe being within very short driving or walking distance of these stores may add to the value in some way, though this day and age, with everybody having a car.
I mean, like here, for example, it says homeowners near Trader Joe's have a 5-year home appreciation average of 67% compared to 52% of homeowners near Whole Foods and 51% near Aldi.
Okay. Well, I don't really know what Aldi is, but I know it's a very popular German grocery store that has recently announced they're going to do a major expansion in the United States. Be that as it may, we are out of time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. She's a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Well, it's August and time for a mid-year analysis, as well as perhaps a little crystal ball thinking. Tushar Yadav, Vice President in the iShares America's Capital Markets Research and Content team, joins me today to look at the current investment environment and kind of give us an idea of what BlackRock is thinking. Tushar, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, sir.
All right. So we've had a very interesting first half of 2017. We've had markets rising. We've had U.S. markets, international markets rising. We've had below average volatility. One of the key themes that investors seem to be worrying about right now is the current length of this cycle of expansion in the U.S. markets and the U.S. economy. So my question really is, it's been a long time. It's been an eight-year expansion, and there's feelings that it may be ready to die of old age. What is BlackRock's view of the remaining lifespan of this bull run?
We're actually quite positive that the run has longer to go, right? And I think there's a couple of components to that. The first is the market side of it. And when you look at equities, especially in the U.S. and globally, we continue to sort of emphasize the fact that bull markets don't die of old age. They die because of recessions. And so that brings up the economic point of view. And I think you rightly sort of say this economic cycle has been a little longer than the previous ones we've experienced. But I think if you think back to the other ones we've experienced in history, you could say that they've been a bit faster. Mm. And this one's been a very slow, very gradual grind as we sort of recovered out of one of the worst recessions in modern memory. And we're now starting to move along. But the pace isn't, overreaching itself. It's continuing in this slow grind with pretty little variability in between it. And as we look at it in that context, the length of this cycle is kind of irrelevant. I think the pace and what's left in it is what's important to investors. And we don't think it's getting away from us at the moment. And we don't think that we are at a point where we're close to potential output in the economy or even beyond it and at peak.
Interesting.
So that's a good sign overall.
Okay. Well, you know, the four most worrisome words when you're in a long-term bull market is this time is different. I'm sure you've heard that before. The idea that we're in a new dawn, it's a new day, a new paradigm, and so on. So, Tushar, is this time different?
Well, there's always sort of equal measures of caution and insight from, you know, phrases that are that incredibly reductive, but that incredibly insightful. And I think the important point to remember is obviously each economic cycle is going to be different from the other. It's going to be different than the 1950s. It's going to be different than the dot-com era or the pre-financial crisis from the housing bubble. So, you know, there is differences in the cycle in that respect. I think the insight that you can gain from it is, well, what's caused cycles to end in the past? Mm-hmm. And that's maybe over-leveraging, you know, maybe a paradigm shift, as you noted, that causes investors to pay drastic amounts more for the same sort of economic value that they've been getting in the past. And while there are some signs of that, we don't see anything that's gotten, you know, over its skis. And so there is cause for concern in maybe one or two little pockets, but those are well identified by the market. Mm-hmm. And we think that, you know, overall, the health of the economy isn't at risk from those areas.
All right, well, let's talk about volatility. Volatility has been very, very low, almost historically low. And some investors worry if this is not the calm before the storm. What do you say?
Yeah, I'll try and tell you that, volatility is a lead indicator of nothing other than, you know, TV ratings and financial press readership.
Okay.
Because, you know, it is a symptom, it is a coincident indicator, and it's something that we should just look at it in that respect alone. And we've done a lot of work on volatility this summer, because when we started our year ahead outlook, you know, it was all quite bullish. It was a decently rosy picture. Not much has changed for us, actually. A lot of it's come true, as you noted at the start. The stock indices everywhere are much higher. But all we tend to hear from client meetings and our interactions is a lot of concern and a lot of complaining. And so I think we spend a lot of time focusing on where those pain points are. And volatility is one. And I think, you know, if you give me a minute here, I'll give you the aha, I think, of our research. And the big takeaway is for us, it's not this, you know, mean reverting concept. It doesn't have a simple equilibrium that it's gravitationally sort of pulled back to. If you think about it over time, it's much more regime dependent. And our research has shown when you're in a low volatility regime, which we've been in for over 80% of the time since the 1870s, it's incredibly persistent. And the likelihood of switching to a higher volatility regime is actually very, very low, and it's driven by the economy. Mm-hmm. So when we looked at economic volatility, which, you know, as I mentioned at the start, we're really just not seeing, the likelihood that low volatility is some sort of warning signal and, you know, it's the calm before the storm and you're seeing all these animals rush for the shelters,
Yeah. It's
just not happening. And I think that that's the big takeaway here, is that low volatility is reflecting the fact that the economy is actually quite healthy and has very low volatility itself.
Okay.
And so the stocks and the sort of options indexes are just pricing that.
Okay. Well, I think that's an understandable answer. I think when you use the term regime, you're really kind of talking about the trend or the kind of the state of the environment at this time. And I think if I'm understanding you correctly, you're basically saying that these so-called regimes tend to last a long time. And today they're based on the fact that really economies are more stable. They're not overheating. There's not a lot of inflation. There's not a lot of these problems that can afflict an economy. So low inflation, low interest rates, a slow growing economy would lead to lower volatility. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. A lot of my people I speak to ask me, firstly, when they come in, I'm an investment advisor, and they said, what about politics across the world, and especially right now in the United States? What about the political regime? Let's use that word in its historical context. What do you think the effect is of the government on the economy and therefore on our investments?
You know, it's a great question. It's one that continues to come up, and we know it's on investors' minds. I think there's two things you can really look at it here. And you can look at what you can price in the future as likely to happen or happening, and there's what you can't price. And I think, you know, the environment today is a lot of the latter, right? We don't know any firm details on tax reform. We don't know any firm details on, you know, first healthcare before you can even get to tax reform in the US. So it's tough to reflect that in the way you would price a stock, or, you know, if you think about it, a series of cash flows. And then, you know, there's the bigger geopolitics, right? And the bigger concern about what country X and country Y begin to accelerate their dispute and get into, you know, either a trade war, a real war.
Yeah.
These are things that, you know, while you can see, and it's maybe driving some concern, which helps to keep yields low in safe instruments and helps to keep safe havens like FX and gold continuing to be popular, it's not at a level where we think that markets are overly concerned. Now, that could dramatically change. And that takes us to the former, where you can actually start to price what the outcome is. We just don't see that happening at the moment, and markets aren't reflecting that either.
Do you see any case for gold in the current situation right now with North Korea?
You know, gold is something that, you know, in any commodity that gives you a diversification benefit in a portfolio is something that we like. We think about portfolios and asset allocation from a strategic point of view. So I'm holding it for a long period of time, and each instrument that I'm holding or you know, asset class I'm adding has a purpose to an overall goal. And in that context, you know, gold is a great diversifier. And we think that holding, you know, gold and other diversifiers from the majority of your holdings, which are traditionally stocks and bonds, is always a good idea.
Okay.
Tactically, as an investment, you know, so I think this is going to rapidly appreciate or not. You know, we haven't seen gold dramatically rise as a result of tensions, you know, in Asia, for example. And what we've seen, which is a bigger really sort of market fundamental driver, is the real rate environment in the US has changed because rates are moving higher. And, you know, the pricing of inflation is starting to come back again. And in those environments, gold historically doesn't do fantastic
Yeah. As
a tactical investment. And I think that's what investors need to sort of hold on to, is if you're making a tactical bet, you need to have a driver. We don't see the drivers being particularly strong at the moment for it. But from a strategic point of view, why do I hold it in a portfolio? It's among a list of really good diversifiers that you can add to a portfolio.
Okay. My guest is Tushar Yadav. He's vice president in the iShares America's Capital Markets Research and Content team. And we're talking about this year, we're talking about investing, trying to earn a decent return on your money, trying to figure out what may happen in the near future and how to diversify. So, Tushar, we have seen foreign markets. I mean, obviously, we're U.S.-based, so everybody else are foreigners, you know. But
right.
We've seen foreign markets significantly outperform U.S. stocks this year, almost to the tune of twice the rate of return. When we look overseas, we look at developed markets, France, Germany, Japan, and those kinds of countries, and then we look at emerging markets as well. Give us a sense of what's going on overseas. Give us a sense of perhaps relative valuations to the U.S. and perhaps what you see going forward.
Yeah, for us, this picture is quite easy to paint. And I'll talk about foreign markets, but ignore the accent for a moment. So what I will say is, you know, when we look at the world and we look at global growth, we see it currently accelerating and in a moment of a sustained global expansion. And we see it actually being a little underpriced by the market. And so when that happens, we look at it and we say, well, what are the areas that are most sensitive to an uptick in global growth? And what are the asset classes that would be, you know, most sensitive to pricing higher global growth? And in each of those instances, the answer comes back, well, the emerging markets, Japan and Europe. And then when we look at these stock markets and we say, well, all right, what is the valuations telling us? Again, these are more reasonably valued markets that are moving based on good earnings, so good, you know, corporate performance, rather than just paying higher for a dollar of earnings, which has been a very big driver in the US year to date. So when we look at all of those, right, the answer sort of very easily comes back to Japan, emerging markets, and Europe. And then the last thing is the performance of the US dollar has surprised a lot of people actually this year in weakening. That could be in part because global trade has been a lot stronger. So, you know, money flows have been reflecting that, you know, flowing away and the dollar has been weakening. And as a result of that, in a good global trade environment, again, these are the nations, they're current account exporters, right? So they're net exporters to the world that will benefit in that environment.
Yeah.
So the picture's been quite rosy. The earnings picture's been quite rosy as a result of it. And, you know, when you add that all together, it's a compelling argument to be looking at international investments, especially for the U.S., because we tend to have a very strong home country bias in this country.
Very, very strong. You know, you deal with countries and clients overseas. What is their bias like? I know, again, we love our home team here. How do they view the U.S. and view their markets?
Well, everyone has, and when I talk to investors internationally, I can tell you, everyone has a home country bias. I think the post-crisis era has been such a reflection of how the policy response was that you saw, you know, the U.S. act first and boldest in a lot of ways. And that's dictated, I think, a lot of the way the policy has run globally afterwards. And as a result of that, I think when markets, you know, when foreign investors look at their own markets, they have their own home country biases as well. And, you know, in Europe, they're much more bond and dividend and value oriented than they are, you know, with a stock market culture, you could argue. In Japan, you know, again, they're much more sort of aligned to safe haven instruments. These biases sort of add up a little bit. But what we tend to see is when they view this market, the US, it's very much the leader in how policy is dictating globally in terms of monetary policy and what central banks are doing, and also where equities might take their cue from, because the marginal dollar of risk is generally sort of flowing in this market here in the US.
A lot of money has been flowing overseas this year, billions and billions of dollars. Do you see that as continuing? Do you continue to see the continued outperformance of foreign markets versus the U.S.? Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, we absolutely do for the second half of this year, and that's something we detail in our outlook again. I think what's interesting to note here is, take the example of the emerging markets, but it's certainly true for Europe and Japan as well, is that we're still quite some distance off of what we would call the peak investment into sort of these foreign holdings. So emerging markets is just the example I use because it's such a clear example. They peaked in terms of the fund assets, mutual funds and ETFs tracking emerging market instruments. That peaked in 2013. We're still about $190 billion off of that peak. And that's, you know, ignoring the growth in portfolios and the growth in assets over that period of time, which could make it even greater. So it shows that investors still haven't returned to these international markets, and there's still some sort of gap to close, even though we've had such strong flows this year.
So you see a strong possibility that those numbers will continue to rise and that foreign markets will do well. Unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest, Tushar Yadav, Vice President of the iShares America's Capital Markets Research and Content Team. And Tushar, I guess one can say that iShares or BlackRock, and the research that you get from all these other sources remains pretty bullish, correct?
Yeah, I would say for the latter part of this year, that's definitely the case in our outlook.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for joining me, Tushar.
Thanks for having us on.
All right, to hear this conversation again and to sign up for our weekly update, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. This week on the On the Money Minute, understanding 529 college savings plans. Hi, this is Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. Section 529 college savings plans still are very popular types of savings accounts for college. I talk about them on occasion on my radio programs, but a lot of these college plans have been ridiculed for high fees, poor investment options, and poor selling practices on the part of financial people who sell them. Thankfully, a lot of that has gotten cleaned up in recent years. So, does that mean that 529 plans never make sense? No. But what it does mean, however, is that parents need to do a fair amount of research before investing in a plan. Unfortunately, those who invest in a lousy plan probably would have been better off investing in their own taxable account. But by choosing the right 529 savings plan, parents can come out ahead in the end. I'm Steve Pomerantz. To hear more on the Money Minutes, plus Steve's weekly radio show, go to stevepomerantz.com. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.